She still loved Don Juan, but she was determined to turn the tables. Finding out through a mutual friend that he'd returned to Madrid, she took the 5,000 pesetas he had sent her and bought expensive clothes. She borrowed a neighbor's child, asked the neighbor's cousin to play the child's nursemaid, and rented a coach, all to create an elaborate fantasy that existed only in his mind. Cristeta didn't even have to lie. She never actually said she was married or had a child. She knew that being unable to have her would make him want her more than ever. It was the only way to seduce a man like him. Overwhelmed by the lengths she had gone to and by the emotions she had so skillfully stirred in him, Don Juan forgave Cristeta and offered to marry her. To his surprise, and perhaps to his relief, she politely declined. The moment they married, she said, his eyes would wander elsewhere. Only if they stayed as they were could she maintain the upper hand. Don Juan had no choice but to agree. Interpretation. Cristeta and Don Juan are characters in the novel Dulce y Sabrosa, Sweet and Savory, from 1891, by the Spanish writer Jacinto Octavio Picón. Most of Picón's work deals with male seducers and their feminine victims, a subject he studied and knew much about. Abandoned by Don Juan and reflecting on his nature, Cristeta decided to kill two birds with one stone. She would get revenge and get him back. But how could she lure such a man? The fruit once tasted, he no longer wanted it. What came easily to him or fell into his arms held no allure for him. What would tempt Don Juan into desiring Cristeta again, into pursuing her, was the sense that she was already taken, that she was forbidden fruit. That was his weakness. That was why he pursued virgins and married women, women he was not supposed to have. To a man, she reasoned, the grass always seems greener somewhere else. She would make herself that distant, alluring object just out of reach, tantalizing him, stirring up emotions he could not control. He knew how charming and desirable she had once been to him. The idea of possessing her again and the pleasure he imagined it would bring were too much for him. He swallowed the bait. Temptation is a twofold process. First, you are coquettish, flirtatious. You stimulate a desire by promising pleasure and distraction from daily life. At the same time, you make it clear to your targets that they cannot have you, at least not right away. You are establishing a barrier, some kind of tension. In days gone by, such barriers were easy to create by taking advantage of pre-existing social obstacles of class, race, marriage, religion. Today, the barriers have to be more psychological. Your heart is taken by someone else. You're really not interested in the target. Some secret holds you back. The timing is bad. You're not good enough for the other person. The other person is not good enough for you, and so on. Conversely, you can choose someone who has a built-in barrier. They are taken. They are not meant to want you. These barriers are more subtle than the social or religious variety, but they are barriers nevertheless, and the psychology remains the same. People are perversely excited by what they cannot or should not have. Create this inner conflict. There is excitement and interest, but you are unavailable, and you will have them grasping like Tantalus for water. And as with Don Juan and Cristeta, the more you make your targets pursue you, the more they imagine that it is they who are the aggressors. Your seduction is perfectly disguised. Keys to seduction. Most of the time, people struggle to maintain security and a sense of balance in their lives. If they were always uprooting themselves in pursuit of every new person or fantasy that passed them by, they could not survive the daily grind. They usually win the struggle, but it doesn't come easy. The world is full of temptation. They read about people who have more than they do, about adventures others are having, about people who have found wealth and happiness, the security that they strive for, and that they seem to have in their lives, is actually an illusion. It covers up a constant tension. As a seducer, you can never mistake people's appearance for reality. You know that their fight to keep order in their lives is exhausting, and that they are gnawed by doubts and regrets. It's hard to be good and virtuous, always having to repress the strongest desires. With that knowledge in mind, seduction is easier. What people want is not temptation. Temptation happens every day. What people want is to give in to temptation, to yield. That is the only way to get rid of the tension in their lives. It costs much more to resist temptation than to surrender. Your task, then, is to create a temptation that is stronger than the daily variety. It has to be focused on them, aimed at them as individuals, at their weakness. Understand, everyone has a principal weakness from which others stem. Find that childhood insecurity, that lack in their life, and you hold the key to tempting them. Their weakness may be greed, vanity, boredom, some deeply repressed desire, a hunger for forbidden fruit. They signal it in little details that elude their conscious control, their style of clothing, an offhand comment. Their past, and particularly their past romances, will be littered with clues. Give them a potent temptation, tailored to their weakness, and you can make the hope of pleasure that you stir in them figure more prominently than the doubts and anxieties that accompany it. In 1621, King Philip III of Spain desperately wanted to forge an alliance with England by marrying his daughter to the son of the English king, James I. James seemed open to the idea, but he stalled for time. Spain's ambassador to the English court, a man named Gondomar, was given the task of advancing Philip's plan. He set his sights on the king's favorite, the Duke, former Earl of Buckingham. Gondomar knew the Duke's main weakness, vanity. Buckingham hungered for the glory and adventure that would add to his fame. He was bored with his limited tasks, and he pouted and whined about this. The ambassador first flattered him profusely. The Duke was the ablest man in the country, and it was a shame he was given so little to do. Then he began to whisper to him of a great adventure. The Duke, as Gondomar knew, was in favor of the match with the Spanish princess, but these damned marriage negotiations with King James were taking so long and getting nowhere. What if the Duke were to accompany the king's son, his good friend, Prince Charles, to Spain? Of course, this would have to be done in secret, without guards or escorts, for the English government and its ministers would never sanction such a trip. But that would make it all the more dangerous and romantic. Once in Madrid, the prince could throw himself at Princess Maria's feet, declare his undying love, and carry her back to England in triumph. What a chivalrous deed it would be, and all for love. The Duke would get all the credit, and it would make his name famous for centuries. The Duke fell for the idea, and convinced Charles to go along. After much arguing, they also convinced a reluctant King James. The trip was a near disaster. Charles would have had to convert to Catholicism to win Maria, and the marriage never happened, but Gondomar had done his job. He didn't bribe the Duke with offers of money or power. He aimed at the childlike part of him that never grew up. A child has little power to resist. It wants everything, now, and rarely thinks of the consequences. A child lies lurking in everyone, a pleasure that was denied them, a desire that was repressed. Hit at that point, tempt them with the proper toy, adventure, money, fun, and they will slough off their normal adult reasonableness. Recognize their weakness by whatever childlike behavior they reveal in daily life. It is the tip of the iceberg. Napoleon Bonaparte was appointed the Supreme General of the French Army in 1796. His commission was to defeat the Austrian forces that had taken over northern Italy. The obstacles were immense. Napoleon was only 26 at the time. The generals below him were envious of his position and doubtful of his abilities. His soldiers were tired, underfed, underpaid, and grumpy. How could he motivate this group to fight the highly experienced Austrian army? As he prepared to cross the Alps into Italy, Napoleon gave a speech to his troops that may have been the turning point in his career and in his life. He said, "Soldiers, you are half-starved and half-naked. The government owes you much, but can do nothing for you. Your patience, your courage do you honor, but give you no glory. I will lead you into the most fertile plains of the world. There you will find flourishing cities, teeming provinces. There you will reap honor, glory, and wealth." The speech had a powerful effect. Days later, these same soldiers, after a rough climb over the mountains, gazed down on the Piedmont Valley. Napoleon's words echoed in their ears, and a ragged, grumbling gang became an inspired army that would sweep across northern Italy in pursuit of the Austrians. Napoleon's use of temptation had two elements. Behind you is a grim past. Ahead of you is a future of wealth and glory if you follow me. Integral to the temptation strategy is a clear demonstration that the target has nothing to lose and everything to gain. The present offers little hope. The future can be full of pleasure and excitement. Remember to keep the future gains vague, though, and somewhat out of reach. Be too specific, and you'll disappoint. Make the promise too close at hand, and you won't be able to postpone satisfaction long enough to get what you want. The barriers and tensions in temptation are there to stop people from giving in too easily and too superficially. You want them to struggle, to resist, to be anxious. Queen Victoria surely fell in love with her prime minister, Benjamin Disraeli, but there were barriers of religion. He was a dark-skinned Jew. Class, she, of course, was a queen. Social taste, she was a paragon of virtue, he a notorious dandy. The relationship was never consummated, but what deliciousness those barriers gave to their daily encounters, which were full of constant flirtation. Many such social barriers are gone today, so they have to be manufactured. It's the only way to put spice into seduction. Taboos of any kind are a source of tension, and they are psychological now, not religious. You're looking for some repression, some secret desire that will make your victim squirm uncomfortably if you hit upon it, but will tempt them all the more. Search in their past. Whatever they seem to fear or flee from might hold the key. It could be a yearning for a mother or father figure, or a latent homosexual desire. Perhaps you can satisfy that desire by presenting yourself as a masculine woman or a feminine man. For others, you play the Lolita or the daddy, someone they are not supposed to have, the dark side of their personality. Keep the connection vague. You want them to reach for something elusive, something that comes out of their own mind. In London in 1769, Casanova met a young woman named Charpillon. She was much younger than he, as beautiful a woman as he had ever known, and with a reputation for destroying men. In one of their first encounters, she told him straight out that he would fall for her and she would ruin him. To everyone's disbelief, Casanova pursued her. In each encounter, she hinted she might give in, perhaps the next time, if he was nice to her. She inflamed his curiosity. What pleasure she would yield. He would be the first. He would tame her. "The venom of desire penetrated my whole being so completely," he later wrote, "that had she so wished it, she could have despoiled me of everything I possessed. I would have beggared myself for one little kiss. This affair indeed proved his ruin. She humiliated him. Charpillon had rightly gauged that Casanova's primary weakness was his need for conquest, to overcome challenge, to taste what no other man had tasted. Beneath this was a kind of masochism, a pleasure in the pain a woman could give him. Playing the impossible woman, enticing and then frustrating him, she offered the ultimate temptation. What will often do the trick is to give the target the sense that you are a challenge, a prize to be won. In possessing you, they'll get what no other has had. They may even get pain. But pain is close to pleasure and offers its own temptations. In the Old Testament, we read that, quote, David arose from his couch and was walking upon the roof of the king's house, and he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful, unquote. The woman was Bathsheba. David summoned her, seduced her, supposedly, then proceeded to get rid of her husband, Uriah, in battle. In fact, however, it was Bathsheba who had seduced David. She bathed on her roof at an hour when she knew he would be standing on his balcony. After tempting a man she knew had a weakness for women, she played the coquette, forcing him to come after her. This is the opportunity strategy. Give someone weak the chance to have what they lust after by merely placing yourself within their reach, as if by accident. Temptation is often a matter of timing, of crossing the path of the weak at the right moment, giving them the opportunity to surrender. Bathsheba used her entire body as a lure, but it is often more effective to use only a part of the body, creating a fetish-like effect. Madame Récamier would let you glimpse her body beneath the sheer dresses she wore, but only briefly, when she took off her overgarment to dance. Men would leave that evening, dreaming of what little they had seen. Empress Josephine made a point of baring her beautiful arms in public. Give the target only a part of you to fantasize about, thereby creating a constant temptation in their mind. Reversal. The reverse of temptation is security or satisfaction, and both are fatal to seduction. If you cannot tempt someone out of their habitual comfort, you cannot seduce them. If you satisfy the desire you've awakened, the seduction is over. There's no reversal to temptation. Although some stages can be passed over, no seduction can proceed without some form of temptation, so it's always better to plan it carefully, tailoring it to the weakness and childishness in your particular target. Phase 2. Lead astray, creating pleasure and confusion. Your victims are sufficiently intrigued, and their desire for you is growing, but their attachment is weak, and at any moment they could decide to turn back. The goal in this phase is to lead your victims so far astray, keeping them emotional and confused, giving them pleasure but making them want more, that retreat is no longer possible. Springing on them a pleasant surprise will make them see you as delightfully unpredictable, but will also keep them off balance. Chapter 9, keep them in suspense. What comes next? The artful use of soft and pleasant words will intoxicate them and stimulate fantasies. Chapter 10, use the demonic power of words to sow confusion. Aesthetic touches and pleasant little rituals will titillate their senses, distract their minds. Chapter 11. Pay attention to detail. Your greatest danger in this phase is the mere hint of routine or familiarity. You need to maintain some mystery, to keep a little distance, so that in your absence your victims become obsessed with you. Chapter 12. Poeticize your presence. They may realize they're falling for you, but they must never suspect how much of this has come from your manipulations. a well-timed display of your weakness, of how emotional you have become under their influence, will help cover your tracks. Chapter 13, Disarm Through Strategic Weakness and Vulnerability. To excite your victims and make them highly emotional, you must give them the feeling that they're actually living some of the fantasies you have stirred in their imagination. Chapter 14, Confused Desire and Reality. By giving them only a part of the fantasy, you will keep them coming back for more. Focusing your attention on them so that the rest of the world fades away, even taking them on a trip, will lead them far astray. Chapter 15, Isolate Your Victim. There is no turning back. Chapter 9, Keep Them in Suspense. What Comes Next? The moment people feel they know what to expect from you, your spell on them is broken. More, you have ceded them power. The only way to lead the seduced along and keep the upper hand is to create suspense, a calculated surprise. People love a mystery, and this is the key to luring them further into your web. Behave in a way that leaves them wondering, what are you up to? Doing something they don't expect from you will give them a delightful sense of spontaneity. They won't be able to foresee what comes next. You're always one step ahead and in control. Give the victim a thrill with a sudden change of direction. The Calculated Surprise. In 1753, the 28-year-old Giovanni Casanova met a young girl named Caterina, with whom he fell in love. Her father knew what kind of man Casanova was, and to prevent some mishap before he could marry her off, he sent her away to a convent on the Venetian island of Murano, where she was to remain for 4 years. Casanova, however, was not one to be daunted. He smuggled letters to Caterina. He began to attend mass at the convent several times a week, catching glimpses of her. The nuns began to talk among themselves. Who was this handsome young man who appeared so often? One morning, as Casanova, leaving mass, was about to board a gondola, a servant girl from the convent passed by and dropped a letter at his feet. Thinking it might be from Caterina, he picked it up. It was, indeed, intended for him, but it wasn't from Caterina. Its author was a nun at the convent, who had noticed him on his many visits and wanted to make his acquaintance. Was he interested? If so, he should come to the convent's parlor at a particular time when the nun would be receiving a visitor from the outside world, a friend of hers who was a countess. He could stand at a distance, observe her, and decide whether she was to his liking. Casanova was most intrigued by the letter. Its style was dignified, but there was something naughty about it as well, particularly from a nun. He had to find out more. At the appointed day and time, he stood to the side in the convent parlor and saw an elegantly dressed woman talking with a nun seated behind a grating. He heard the nun's name mentioned and was astonished. It was Matilde M., a well-known Venetian in her early 20s, whose decision to enter a convent had surprised the whole city. But what astonished him most was that beneath her nun's habit, he could see that she was a beautiful young woman, particularly in her eyes, which were a brilliant blue. Perhaps she needed a favor done, and intended that he would serve as her cat's paw. His curiosity got the better of him. A few days later, he returned to the convent and asked to see her. As he waited for her, his heart was beating a mile a minute. He didn't know what to expect. She finally appeared and sat down behind the grating. They were alone in the room, and she said that she could arrange for them to have supper together at a little villa nearby. Casanova was delighted, but wondered what kind of nun he was dealing with. "And have you no lover but me?" he asked. "I have a friend who is also absolutely my master," she replied. "It is to him I owe my wealth." She asked if he had a lover. "Yes," he replied. She then said in a mysterious tone, "I warn you, that if you once allow me to take her place in your heart, no power on earth can tear me from it." She then gave him the key to the villa and told him to meet her there in 2 nights. He kissed her through the grating and left in a daze. "I passed the next 2 days in a state of feverish impatience," he wrote, "which prevented me from sleeping or eating. Over and above birth, beauty, and wit, my new conquest possessed an additional charm. She was forbidden fruit. I was about to become a rival of the church." He imagined her in her habit and with her shaven head. He arrived at the villa at the appointed hour. Matilda was waiting for him. To his surprise, she wore an elegant dress, and somehow she had avoided having her head shaved, for her hair was in a magnificent chignon. Casanova began to kiss her. She resisted, but only slightly, and then pulled back, saying a meal was ready for them. Over dinner, she filled in a few more of the gaps. Her money allowed her to bribe certain people so that she could escape from the convent every so often. She had mentioned Casanova to her friend and master, and he had approved their liaison. "He must be old," Casanova asked. "No," she replied, a glint in her eye. "He is in his 40s and quite handsome." After supper, a bell rang, her signal to hurry back to the convent or she would be caught. She changed back into her habit and left. A beautiful vista now seemed to stretch before Casanova, of months spent in the villa with this delightful creature, all of it courtesy of the mysterious master who paid for it all. He soon returned to the convent to arrange the next meeting. They would rendezvous in a square in Venice, then retire to the villa. At the appointed time and place, Casanova saw a man approaching him. Fearing it was her mysterious friend or some other man sent to kill him, he recoiled. The man circled behind him, then came up close. It was Matilda, wearing a mask and men's clothes. She laughed at the fright she had given him. What a devilish nun! He had to admit that dressed as a man, she excited him even more. Casanova began to suspect that all was not as it seemed. For one, he found a collection of libertine novels and pamphlets in Matilda's house. Then, she made blasphemous comments, for example, about the joy they would have together during Lent, mortifying their flesh. Now she referred to her mysterious friend as her lover. A plan evolved in his mind to take her away from this man and from the convent, eloping with her and possessing her himself. A few days later, he received a letter from her in which she made a confession. During one of their more passionate trysts at the villa, her lover had hidden in a closet, watching the whole thing. The lover, she told him, was the French ambassador to Venice, and Casanova had impressed him. Casanova was not one to be fooled with like this, yet the next day he was back at the convent, submissively arranging for another tryst. This time she showed up at the hour they had named, and he embraced her, only to find that he was embracing Caterina, dressed up in Matilda's clothes. Matilda had befriended Caterina and learned her story. Apparently, taking pity on her, she had arranged it so that Caterina could leave the convent for the evening and meet up with Casanova. Only a few months before, Casanova had been in love with this girl, but he had forgotten about her. Compared to the ingenious Matilda, Caterina was a simpering bore. He could not conceal his disappointment. He burned to see Matilda. Casanova was angry at the trick Matilda had played, but a few days later, when he saw her again, all was forgiven. As she had predicted during their first interview, her power over him was complete. He had become her slave, addicted to her whims and to the dangerous pleasures she offered. Who knows what rash act he might have committed on her behalf had their affair not been cut short by circumstance. Interpretation. Casanova was almost always in control in his seductions. He was the one who led, taking his victim on a trip to an unknown destination, luring her into his web. In all of his memoirs, the story of Matilda is the only seduction in which the tables are happily turned. He is the seduced, the bewildered victim. What made Casanova Matilda's slave was the same tactic he had used on countless girls. The irresistible lure of being led by another person. The thrill of being surprised. The power of mystery. Each time he left Matilda, his head was spinning with questions. Her ability to go on surprising him kept her always in his mind, deepening her spell and blotting Caterina out. Each surprise was carefully calculated for the effect it would produce. The first unexpected letter piqued his curiosity, as did that first sight of her in the waiting room. Suddenly seeing her dressed as an elegant woman stirred intense desire. Then, seeing her dressed as a man intensified the excitingly transgressive nature of their liaison. The surprises put him off balance, yet left him quivering with anticipation of the next one. Even an unpleasant surprise, such as the encounter with Caterina that Matilda had set up, kept him emotional and weak. Meeting the somewhat bland Caterina at that moment only made him long that much more for Matilda. In seduction, you need to create constant tension and suspense, a feeling that with you, nothing is predictable. Don't think of this as a painful challenge. You are creating drama in real life, so pour your creative energies into it. Have some fun. There are all kinds of calculated surprises you can spring on your victims. Sending a letter from out of the blue, showing up unexpectedly, taking them to a place they have never been. But best of all are surprises that reveal something new about your character. This needs to be set up. In those first few weeks, your targets will tend to make certain snap judgments about you based on appearances. Perhaps they see you as a bit shy, practical, puritanical. You know that this isn't the real you, but it is how you act in social situations. Let them, however, have these impressions, and in fact, accentuate them a little, without overacting. For instance, seem a little more reserved than usual. Now you have room to suddenly surprise them with some bold or poetic or naughty action. Once they have changed their minds about you, surprise them again, as Matilda did with Casanova. First a nun who wants an affair, then a libertine, then a seductress with a sadistic streak. As they strain to figure you out, they will be thinking about you all of the time and will want to know more about you. Their curiosity will lead them further into your web until it is too late for them to turn back. Keys to seduction. A child is usually a willful, stubborn creature who will deliberately do the opposite of what we ask. But there is one scenario in which children will happily give up their usual willfulness when they are promised a surprise. Perhaps it's a present hidden in a box, a game with an unforeseeable ending, a journey with an unknown destination, a suspenseful story with a surprise finish. In those moments when children are waiting for a surprise, their willpower is suspended. They're in your thrall for as long as you dangle possibility before them. This childish habit is buried deep within us and is the source of an elemental human pleasure, being led by a person who knows where they're going and who takes us on a journey. Maybe our joy in being carried along involves a buried memory of being literally carried by a parent when we're small. We get a similar thrill when we watch a movie or read a thriller. We're in the hands of a director or author who is leading us along, taking us through twists and turns. We stay in our seats, we turn the pages, happily enslaved by the suspense. It's the pleasure a woman has in being led by a confident dancer, letting go of any defensiveness she may feel, and letting another person do the work. Falling in love involves anticipation. We're about to head off in a new direction, enter a new life where everything will be strange. The seduced wants to be led, to be carried along like a child. If you are predictable, the charm wears off. Everyday life is predictable. In the Arabian Tales from the Thousand and One Nights, each night King Shahryar takes a virgin as his wife, then kills her the following morning. One such virgin, Shahrazad, manages to escape this fate by telling the king a story that can only be completed the following day. She does this night after night, keeping the king in constant suspense. When one story finishes, she quickly starts up another. She does this for nearly 3 years, until the king finally decides to spare her life. You are like Shahrazad. Without new stories, without a feeling of anticipation, your seduction will die. Keep stoking the fires night after night. Your targets must never know what's coming next, what surprises you have in store for them. As with King Shahryar, they will be under your control for as long as you can keep them guessing. In 1765, Casanova met a young Italian countess named Clementina, who lived with her two sisters in a chateau. Clementina loved to read and had little interest in the men who swarmed around her. Casanova added himself to their number, buying her books, engaging in her literary discussions, but she was no less indifferent to him than she had been to them. Then one day, he invited the entire family on a little trip. He wouldn't tell them where they were going. They piled into the carriage all the way trying to guess their destination. A few hours later, they entered Milan. What joy! The sisters had never been there. Casanova led them to his apartment, where three dresses had been laid out, the most magnificent dresses the girls had ever seen. There was one for each of the sisters, he told them, and the green one was for Clementina. Stunned, she put it on, and her face lit up. The surprises did not stop. There was a delicious meal, champagne, games. By the time they returned to the chateau late in the evening, Clementina had fallen hopelessly in love with Casanova. The reason was simple. Surprise creates a moment when people's defenses come down and new emotions can rush in. If the surprise is pleasurable, the seductive poison enters their veins without their realizing it. Any sudden event has a similar effect, striking directly at our emotions before we get defensive. Rakes know this power well. A young married woman in the court of Louis XV in 18th century France noticed a handsome young courtier watching her, first at the opera, then in church. Making inquiries, she found out it was the Duc de Richelieu, the most notorious rake in France. No woman was safe from this man, she was warned. He was impossible to resist, and she should avoid him at all costs. Nonsense, she replied. She was happily married. He could not possibly seduce her. Seeing him again, she laughed at his persistence. He would disguise himself as a beggar and approach her in the park, or his coach would suddenly come alongside hers. He was never aggressive and seemed harmless enough. She let him talk to her at court. He was charming and witty, and even asked to meet her husband. The weeks passed, and the woman realized she had made a mistake. She looked forward to seeing the Marquis. She had let down her guard. This had to stop. Now she started avoiding him, and he seemed to respect her feelings. He stopped bothering her. Then, one day, weeks later, she was at the country manor of a friend when the Marquis suddenly appeared. She blushed, trembled, walked away, but his unexpected appearance had caught her unawares. It had pushed her over the edge. A few days later, she became another of Richelieu's victims. Of course, he had set the whole thing up, including the supposed surprise encounter. Not only does suddenness create a seductive jolt, it conceals manipulations. Appear somewhere unexpectedly, say or do something sudden, and people will not have time to figure out that your move was calculated. Take them to some new place as if it only just occurred to you. Suddenly reveal some secret. Made emotionally vulnerable, they will be too bewildered to see through you. Anything that happens suddenly seems natural, and anything that seems natural has a seductive charm. Only months after arriving in Paris in 1926, Josephine Baker had completely charmed and seduced the French public with her wild dancing. But less than a year later, she could feel their interest wane. Since childhood, she had hated feeling out of control of her life. Why be at the mercy of the fickle public? She left Paris and returned a year later, her manner completely altered. Now she played the part of an elegant Frenchwoman who happened to be an ingenious dancer and performer. The French fell in love with her again. The power was back on her side. If you are in the public eye, you must learn from this trick of surprise. People are bored, not only with their own lives, but with people who are meant to keep them from being bored. The minute they feel they can predict your next step, they will eat you alive. The artist Andy Warhol kept moving from incarnation to incarnation, and no one could predict the next one. Artist, filmmaker, society man, always keep a surprise up your sleeve. To keep the public's attention, keep them guessing. Let the moralists accuse you of insincerity, of having no core or center. They are actually jealous of the freedom and playfulness you reveal in your public persona. Finally, you might think it wiser to present yourself as someone reliable, not given to caprice. If so, you are, in fact, merely timid. It takes courage and effort to mount a seduction. Reliability is fine for drawing people in, but stay reliable and you stay a bore. Dogs are reliable. A seducer is not. If, on the other hand, you prefer to improvise, imagining that any kind of planning or calculation is antithetical to the spirit of surprise, you are making a grave mistake. Constant improvisation simply means you're lazy and thinking only about yourself. What often seduces a person is the feeling that you have expended effort on their behalf. You don't need to trumpet this too loudly, but make it clear in the gifts you make, the little journeys you plan, the little teases you lure people with. Little efforts like these will be more than amply rewarded by the conquest of the heart and willpower of the seduced. Reversal. Surprise can be unsurprising if you keep doing the same thing again and again. Jiang Qing would try to surprise her husband, Mao Zedong, with sudden changes of mood, from harshness to kindness and back. At first, he was captivated. He loved the feeling of never knowing what was coming. But it went on for years and was always the same. Soon, Madame Mao's supposedly unpredictable mood swings just annoyed him. You need to vary the method of your surprises. When Madame de Pompadour was the lover of the inveterately bored King Louis XV, she made each surprise different. A new amusement, a new game, a new fashion, a new mood. He could never predict what would come next, and while he waited for the next surprise, his willpower was temporarily suspended. No man was ever more of a slave to a woman than was Louis to Madame de Pompadour. When you change direction, make the new direction truly new. Chapter 10. Use the demonic power of words to sow confusion. It's hard to make people listen. They are consumed with their own thoughts and desires and have little time for yours. The trick to making them listen is to say what they want to hear, to fill their ears with whatever is pleasant to them. This is the essence of seductive language. Inflame people's emotions with loaded phrases. Flatter them. Comfort their insecurities. Envelop them in fantasies, sweet words, and promises. And not only will they listen to you, they will lose their will to resist you. Keep your language vague, letting them read into it what they want. Use writing to stir up fantasies and to create an idealized portrait of yourself. Seductive oratory. On May 13, 1958, right-wing Frenchmen and their sympathizers in the army seized control of Algeria, which was then a French colony. They had been afraid that France's socialist government would grant Algeria its independence. Now, with Algeria under their control, they threatened to take over all of France. Civil war seemed imminent. At this dire moment, all eyes turned to General Charles de Gaulle, the World War II hero who had played a crucial role in liberating France from the Nazis. For the last 10 years, de Gaulle had stayed away from politics, disgusted with the infighting among the various parties. He remained very popular and was generally seen as the one man who could unite the country. But he was also a conservative, and the right-wingers felt certain that if he came to power, he would support their cause. Days after the May 13th coup, the French government, the Fourth Republic, collapsed, and the parliament called on de Gaulle to help form a new government, the Fifth Republic. He asked for and was granted full powers for 4 months. On June 4th, days after becoming the head of government, de Gaulle flew to Algeria. The French colonials were ecstatic. It was their coup that had indirectly brought de Gaulle to power. Surely, they imagined, he was coming to thank them and to reassure them that Algeria would remain French. When he arrived in Algiers, thousands of people filled the city's main plaza. The mood was extremely festive. There were banners, music, and endless chants of Algérie Française, the French colonial slogan. Suddenly, de Gaulle appeared on a balcony overlooking the plaza. The crowd went wild. The general, an extremely tall man, raised his arms above his head, and the chanting doubled in volume. The crowd was begging him to join in. Instead, he lowered his arms until silence fell, then opened them wide and slowly intoned in his deep voice, "Je vous ai compris. I have understood you." There was a moment of quiet, and then, as his words sank in, a deafening roar, he understood them. That was all they needed to hear. De Gaulle proceeded to talk of the greatness of France. More cheers. He promised there would be new elections, and with those elected representatives, we will see how to do the rest. Yes, a new government, just what the crowd wanted. More cheers. He would find the place for Algeria in the French ensemble. There must be total discipline without qualification and without conditions. Who could argue with that? He closed with a loud call, "Vive la République, vive la France," the emotional slogan that had been the rallying cry in the fight against the Nazis. Everyone shouted it back. In the next few days, de Gaulle made similar speeches around Algeria to equally delirious crowds. Only after de Gaulle had returned to France did the words of his speeches sink in. Not once had he promised to keep Algeria French. In fact, he had hinted that he might give the Arabs the vote, and might grant an amnesty to the Algerian rebels who had been fighting to force the French from the country. Somehow, in the excitement his words had created, the colonists had failed to focus on what they had actually meant. De Gaulle had duped them, and indeed, in the months to come, he worked to grant Algeria its independence, a task he finally accomplished in 1962. Interpretation. De Gaulle cared little about an old French colony and about what it symbolized to some French people. Nor did he have any sympathy for anyone who fomented civil war. His one concern was to make France a modern power. And so, when he went to Algiers, he had a long-term plan. Weaken the right-wingers by getting them to fight among themselves and work toward Algerian independence. His short-term goal had to be to defuse the tension and buy himself some time. He wouldn't lie to the colonials by saying he supported their cause. That would cause trouble back home. Instead, he would beguile them with seductive oratory, intoxicate them with words. His famous, "I have understood you," could easily have meant, "I understand what a danger you represent." But a jubilant crowd expecting a support read it the way they wanted. To keep them at a fever pitch, de Gaulle made emotional references to the French resistance during World War II, for example, and to the need for discipline, a word with great appeal to right-wingers. He filled their ears with promises, a new government, a glorious future. He got them to chant, creating an emotional bond. He spoke with a dramatic pitch and quivering emotion. His words created a kind of delirium. De Gaulle wasn't trying to express his feelings or speak the truth. He was trying to produce an effect. This is the key to seductive oratory. Whether you're talking to a single individual or to a crowd, try a little experiment. Rein in your desire to speak your mind. Before you open your mouth, ask yourself a question. What can I say that will have the most pleasant effect on my listeners? Often, this entails flattering their egos, assuaging their insecurities, giving them vague hopes for the future, sympathizing with their travails. I have understood you. Start off with something pleasant, and everything to come will be easy. People's defenses will go down. They'll grow amenable, open to suggestion. Think of your words as an intoxicating drug that will make people emotional and confused. Keep your language vague and ambiguous, letting your listeners fill in the gaps with their fantasies and imaginings. Instead of tuning you out, getting irritated or defensive, being impatient for you to shut up, they will be pliant, happy with your sweet-sounding words. Seductive writing. One spring afternoon in the late 1830s, in a street in Copenhagen, a man named Johannes caught a glimpse of a beautiful young girl. Self-absorbed, yet delightfully innocent, she fascinated him, and he followed her from a distance and found out where she lived. Over the next few weeks, he made inquiries and found out more about her. Her name was Cordelia Vall, and she lived with her aunt. The two led a quiet existence. Cordelia liked to read and to be alone. Seducing young girls was Johannes's specialty, but Cordelia would be a catch. She had already turned down several eligible suitors. Johannes imagined that Cordelia might hunger for something more out of life, something grand, something resembling the books she had read and the daydreams that presumably filled her solitude. He arranged an introduction and began to frequent her house, accompanied by a friend of his named Edward. This young man had his own thoughts of courting Cordelia, but he was awkward and strained to please her. Johannes, on the other hand, virtually ignored her, instead befriending her aunt. They would talk about the most banal things, farm life, whatever was in the news. Occasionally, Johannes would veer off into a more philosophical discussion, for he had noticed, out of the corner of his eye, that on these occasions Cordelia would listen to him closely, while still pretending to listen to Edward. This went on for several weeks. Johannes and Cordelia barely spoke, but he could tell that he intrigued her, and that Edward irritated her to no end. One morning, knowing her aunt was out, he visited their house. It was the first time he and Cordelia had been alone together. As dryly and politely as possible, he proceeded to propose to her. Needless to say, she was shocked and flustered. A man who had shown not the slightest interest in her suddenly wanted to marry her? She was so surprised that she referred the matter to her aunt, who, as Johannes had expected, gave her approval. Had Cordelia resisted, her aunt would have respected her wishes, but she did not. On the outside, everything had changed. The couple were engaged. Johannes now came to the house alone, sat with Cordelia, held her hand, talked with her. But inwardly, he made sure things were the same. He remained distant and polite. He would sometimes warm up, particularly when talking about literature, Cordelia's favorite subject. But at a certain point, he always went back to more mundane matters. He knew this frustrated Cordelia, who had expected that now he would be different. Yet even when they went out together, he took her to formal socials arranged for engaged couples. How conventional! Was this what love and marriage were supposed to be about? These prematurely aged people talking about houses and their own drab futures? Cordelia, who was shy at the best of times, asked Johannes to stop dragging her to these affairs. The battlefield was prepared. Cordelia was confused and anxious. Then, a few weeks after their engagement, Johannes sent her a letter. Here, he described the state of his soul and his certainty that he loved her. He spoke in metaphor, suggesting that he had been waiting for years, lantern in hand, for Cordelia's appearance. Metaphor melted into reality, back and forth. The style was poetic, the words glowed with desire, but the whole was delightfully ambiguous. Cordelia could reread the letter 10 times without being sure what it said. The next day, Johannes received a response. The writing was simple and straightforward, but full of sentiment. His letter had made her so happy, Cordelia wrote, and she had not imagined this side to his character. He replied by writing that he had changed. He did not say how or why, but the implication was that it was because of her. Now his letters came almost daily. They were mostly of the same length, in a poetic style that had a touch of madness to it, as if he were intoxicated with love. He talked of Greek myth, comparing Cordelia to a nymph and himself to a river that fell in love with a maiden. His soul, he said, merely reflected back her image. She was all he could see or think of. Meanwhile, he detected changes in Cordelia. Her letters became more poetic, less restrained. Without realizing it, she repeated his ideas, imitating his style and his imagery as if they were her own. Also, when they saw each other in person, she was nervous. He made a point of remaining the same, aloof and regal, but he could tell that she saw him differently, sensing depths in him that she could not fathom. In public, she hung on to his every word. She must have memorized his letters, for she referred to them constantly in their talks. It was a secret life they shared. When she held his hand, she did so more tightly than before. Her eyes expressed an impatience, as if she were hoping that at any moment he would do something bold. Johannes made his letters shorter, but more numerous, sometimes sending several in one day. The imagery became more physical and more suggestive, the style more disjointed, as if he could barely organize his thoughts. Sometimes he sent a note of just a sentence or two. Once, at a party at Cordelia's house, he dropped such a note into her knitting basket and watched as she ran away to read it, her face flushed. In her letters, he saw signs of emotion and turmoil. Echoing a sentiment he had hinted at in an earlier letter, she wrote that she hated the whole engagement business. It was so beneath their love. Everything was ready. Soon she would be his, the way he wanted it. She would break off the engagement. A rendezvous in the country would be simple to arrange. In fact, she would be the one to propose it. This would be his most skillful seduction. Interpretation. Johannes and Cordelia are characters in the loosely autobiographical novel The Seducer's Diary from 1843 by the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Johannes is a most experienced seducer who specializes in working on his victim's mind. This is precisely where Cordelia's previous suitors have failed. They have begun by imposing themselves, a common mistake. We think that by being persistent, by overwhelming our targets with romantic attention, we are convincing them of our affection. Instead, we are convincing them of our impatience and insecurity. Aggressive attention is not flattering because it is not personalized. It is unbridled libido at work. The target sees through it. Johannes is too clever to begin so obviously. Instead, he takes a step back, intriguing Cordelia by acting a little cold and carefully creating the impression of a formal, somewhat secretive man. Only then does he surprise her with his first letter. Obviously, there is more to him than she has thought. And once she's come to believe this, her imagination runs rampant. Now he can intoxicate her with his letters, creating a presence that haunts her like a ghost. His words, with their images and poetic references, are constantly in her mind, And this is the ultimate seduction, to possess her mind before moving to conquer her body. The story of Johannes shows what a weapon in a seducer's armory a letter can be. But it is important to learn how to incorporate letters in seduction. It's best not to begin your correspondence until at least several weeks after your initial contact. Let your victims get an impression of you. You seem intriguing, yet you show no particular